Godspeed with Carol and Michael Hollenbach, Sundays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religious and spiritual practices as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbach. If you visit the website of the International Consciousness Research Laboratories in Princeton, New Jersey, you will find quotations that this scientific organization normally associated with great spiritual luminaries. For example, a religion contradicting science and a science contradicting religion are equally false. This from Alan Watts: to have order, you must have randomness, because where there is no randomness, order cannot manifest itself. And this, my favorite: any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. The magic we will be discussing today is the proven effect that human consciousness has on random events and devices around us. Our very special guest today is Brenda Dunn, president of the International Consciousness Research Laboratories, or ICRL. From 1979 to 2007, Brenda served as manager of the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory at Princeton University, or PEAR, PEAR. For three decades, PEAR researched and substantially measured human consciousness. Their work has been described in over 100 articles in journals and books, and is continued today at ICRL. Brenda, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Carol. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Brenda, it can be said that the work of PEAR measured the immeasurable, consciousness. Can you tell us a little bit about the work?
I sure can. The research at the PEAR lab basically was looking at two different forms of anomalous phenomena. The first was whether human intention could possibly affect the physical performance of random number generators, different devices that involved a random physical source. The other part of the program was looking into a phenomenon called remote perception, sometimes called remote viewing, where people attempted to describe remote geographical locations without any recourse to sensory input. These two types of events could very well be regarded as magic, since they don't fit any of our current understandings of the way the world works.
If we could focus on the first one for a moment, the random experiments with, for example, the coin tossing experiment, that's perhaps a good place to start for our listeners to get an idea of the work and the randomness and the effect of a human being.
Sure. Well, that's a good place to start, because the random event generators, or REGs for short, form the basis of the largest portion of our program. These were devices that were designed to produce random binary output that is akin to a coin flipping device, only flipping a lot faster than most coins, yeah, than anybody could flip a coin. Basically, they looked at an electronic noise source and sampled them at intervals, periodic intervals, typically about 1 per second, and looked at whether they were getting a 1 or a 0, or a positive or a negative pulse.
Or a head or a tail.
Or a head or a tail, yeah, right. It would then collect 200 of these counts and then add them up and tell you how many there were in a given trial. So by chance, you would expect to get about 100 heads and 100 tails.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, you're not always going to get 100. Sometimes you'll get 97 heads, or you might get 106 tails. But the point was that if you do this hundreds of thousands of times, the law of large numbers tells you that the mean or the average is going to get closer and closer to the theoretical number of 100. So our experiments had people interacting with these devices simply by looking at them, thinking about them, and having a desire to get higher numbers or lower numbers. And the experiment alternated three different intentions in some random fashion. And these intentions were the only thing that changed in the course of an experimental series. Pardon me. In one case, the operator would attempt to get more numbers over 100 to go high, in another to go low or get more numbers under 100. And in the third version, it would be to not do anything, just let the machine do its own thing. We call this a baseline. In a sense, a baseline is a control run, and there is no stated intention mentioned. Over the years, we produced many hundreds of thousands, probably millions, of such trials with several hundred volunteer operators. We don't speak of subjects because we weren't testing the people. We were testing the machine. And what we found was that there was indeed a small but consistent shift in the directions that correlated with the intentions. When people were trying to go high, the machine was producing slightly more higher numbers. And when they were trying to go low, they were producing more low numbers.
And this only done by their presence in the room?
Well, I can get into that in a little while, because in some cases we did these in a remote protocol where they weren't even in the room.
Wow.
They were actually up to thousands of miles away. And the distance between the operator and the machine didn't seem to make much difference. As I started to indicate, and as this is important, the effects were very tiny. There was no one trial that was dramatic that you'd say, aha, there's the anomaly. What was the anomaly was the statistical nature of this output, that there were just far too many numbers that correlated with the intentions than there should have been just by chance.
I appreciate your use of the word intention. In some of your video that I looked over, you had mentioned that in terms of the experiments, that people who were working on this, or the operators, as you say, had better luck the first time sometimes than when they started to think about it, because you'd found this wasn't really a cognitive or learning process, but seemed to be something more intuitive.
Yes, that was one of the more surprising and informative findings of our work. And we found this across all of the experiments we did. We came to refer to it as a series position effect. The reason it's important is because in the past, a lot of experiments looking at psychic phenomena ran into this. But because they did not conduct as many experimental trials as we did, it was dismissed as a so-called decline effect. And indeed, it was one of the reasons why many critics of the field tended to dismiss it. They would say, it's just chance. It goes away.
Mm.
But in our experiments, we had people continuing. We asked them to keep going, not to worry about the result they got, but just to have a good time. And we found that very often they would do very well on their first effort. And then on their second effort, they'd get null or even negative effects. By the time they got to the third or fourth effort, the result returned. It wasn't quite as large as it had been initially, but it did consistently chunk away. You know, you spend many years trying to figure out what the implications of this are. And we've concluded that it had to do with the operators' initial experience being one of, if you will, high uncertainty. They had no idea what to expect. They came in and said, okay, this sounds crazy, but I'll try it anyway. And they got a result, and they went, wow, this really works.
Then they started thinking
now,
too hard.
Of course, being unable to step in the same stream twice, they would return to the task with a totally different attitude. Oh, I could do this. This is simple. All I have to do is what I did before. And now they were approaching it with a very different, more deliberate, planned attempt, with a cognitive intention, if you will, not the openness to, hey, whatever,
right,
that they had the first time. And when they were trying too hard, it turned out that they weren't able to get the results. They then might say, oh, well, it was just chance anyhow, you know, it was just dumb luck. I'll just go back and have some fun with it, and the heck with what happens. And then the effect would return a little bit more cautiously. But we saw this in the high-going efforts. We saw it in the low-going efforts. We saw it across many different experiments with different devices. But we didn't see it in our calibration data. We didn't see it in the baselines. So clearly, this series position effect was associated with the consciousness or intention or attitude of the human operator.
Yes, and the openness that you mentioned before may have been part of that. So if it isn't mind over matter and it isn't really a cognitive, you know, goal, then what is consciousness then?
Yeah, that's a simple question, isn't it?
Really? You heard it here on the Godspeed.
ask 100 people and you'll get 100 different answers.
Right. In this context, though, what would you be measuring then?
Well, you know,
what are they using?
Just to clarify our own use of the term, there are a lot of people who relate or connect consciousness with brain activity. They regard consciousness as a sort of epiphenomenon, if you will, of the brain or of the neural, you know, system. And it's a rather physical definition. That is not how we use the term. In the way we use the term, consciousness is that subjective sense of self. And compared with the sense of not self, this is me, that is not me. Okay? And consciousness in that approach is that which organizes the self's experience of its environment. It takes it in, it sorts it, it categorizes it, and translates it into some kind of meaning. Okay? It becomes information. Now, this varies from one person to another. You and I could read the same book, but we may very well be reading two different books, depending on why we're reading it, what language we speak, you know, our interest, and so forth.
Yes.
So we speak of the term consciousness as an organizing principle. The brain is what puts out the bottom line, but it is the consciousness that is the input to the brain for purposes of organization. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
You can think of it kind of like a radio. We're talking on the phone here, and somebody out there is listening to this conversation on their radio. But you and I are not in the radio. Our conversation, you and I are not even in the same room, but
right,
our conversation is somehow being transmitted in some wave-like character. And a radio is a device that is designed to pick up these waves and transform them into an audible sound. I think the brain, this serves as a fairly good analogy of the, you know, the brain versus consciousness and the way we use it.
No, that's very helpful. Definitely. Thank you.
So what is consciousness? Consciousness is that which organizes our experiences and creates our reality.
And, you know, it's interesting. I wonder sometimes if we're having an experience of sort of a mass remembering as we go into areas like this of study. It seems to me there's an intuitive connection between things that we know as human beings. We know it's there. We know it's been there. We look at something like Stonehenge as a mystery. Who built that?
Mm-hmm.
I think we have sort of a massive, you know, memory issue here that somehow we knew on some level to connect
our
consciousness with the matter around us.
That's a very important point. You know, there are some people who claim that this is a capability that can be learned. I've never quite resonated with that. I've always thought of it as something that can be remembered.
There you go.
Something that we are innately born with, but we are educated out of. Our language, our educational system, our culture, our all of the factors in our world that tell us what is real tends to downplay that side. It's curious that children seem to be much better at this sort of thing. Animals are good at it. They know. They haven't yet learned that it's not possible. Like the series position effects, they haven't started thinking about it and wondering why it works. Which, of course, as soon as you start thinking about it, like most innate capabilities of that sort, it goes away.
Yes.
And you lose the contact with it.
Yeah, it's like a changing of channels.
Yes. It's something we definitely have. I can't say we definitely, but we certainly seem to have had all along, but have gotten out of touch with. And, of course, this is one of the purposes of ICRL and of the pair work, was to try to bring this back into awareness and, indeed, to be able to demonstrate its reality using the tools and concepts of modern science, which does hold a lot of authority in our world in terms of what's real and what isn't.
Yeah.
And to say, look, science itself now, using scientific method, we're able to demonstrate that the body of scientific knowledge that we have right now is not complete. Science is a tool of consciousness. Science is something that the mind does. And so if you are going to speak about science and exclude the mind or the scientist, you've only got half the picture.
Yes. Well, this may be a good time to then ask about the scientists and to tell us a bit about PAIR and its history and development. How did it originate? Where did it come from?
Well, it originated with an undergraduate independent project. There was an engineering undergraduate many years ago, back in the mid-70s, who had read about some work that was published by Helmut Schmidt, a physicist who at the time was working for Boeing, in which he described that people could affect random number generators. The student was very impressed by this and thought it would make a neat independent project, but ran into a little bit of headwind when she went to various members of her faculty asking for supervision. It was dismissed as sort of nonsense or pseudoscience or one excuse after another. But she recalled that when she had entered the university as a freshman, she'd been welcomed in a speech by the dean of engineering, who said that if they did well in their studies, when they got to be juniors and seniors, they'd be able to take on independent projects on any topic that they wished. And she was now a junior, and this was the topic that she wished, and she wished that the dean would supervise it. Robert John, my colleague at PAIR, was dean of the engineering school at that time, the position he held for some 15 years. His main area of study was advanced aerospace propulsion systems. So he was really not terribly into this topic, but he was a rocket scientist.
Yes.
But he was also a teacher. And somebody who believed that students should be able to explore the tough questions and not be discouraged from asking questions that weren't popular. So he did agree to supervise the project. After the first year, I should also mention, he also felt that the design and construction of a random event generator was a perfectly legitimate engineering project, regardless of what kind of findings. So the student did design and construct a rudimentary random event generator, carried out some experiments that had results very consistent with what Dr. Schmidt had found. And Dean John looked at these results and went,
Okay.
As an engineer, you know, he found himself wondering about the potential implication of a phenomenon like this, if they were indeed real, for contemporary and indeed future engineering systems and processes. You know, we were at the time then, if you can think back to 1979, we were just moving from punch cards to mainframe VAX computers.
Yes.
Information science was in its infancy. But it was clear that this was the direction that science was going to be going. And it was also clear that these information processing systems needed to be very carefully isolated and controlled to avoid any kind of artifacts influencing their output.
Right.
So he, with the encouragement of a colleague of his from the aerospace business, James McDonnell, who had shared this concern with regard to some of his very sophisticated jet aircraft, which also occasionally demonstrated anomalous phenomena, you know, gremlins, they used to call them.
Yes, oh yeah.
And he felt that it was very important to study this very carefully. And so Mr. McDonnell agreed to provide the funding for this program, and Professor John established the program in the engineering school in 1979. And he invited me to come and serve as the laboratory manager of PEAR. My own background was quite different. My background is in psychology and the humanities. But this is a very important feature because from the very outset, we believed that this type of study required a multidisciplinary attack, that you couldn't understand it from just one perspective. You needed to look at it from different angles. And so I brought a more humanistic, if you will, a more philosophical, a more psychological perspective, and he brought the highly technical, analytical, mathematical approach. And together, we blended these skills and carried on for some 28 years in this research. The experiments that I had done before I came to Princeton, I had gotten involved in the field through the study of the remote perception, where I had attempted to replicate some studies that had been reported at SRI, indicating that people could describe remote geographical locations. And I had replicated that study and published it, and when we met, we agreed that these were two complementary areas. They were not totally different. They had something in common.
Brenda, do you mean that they could describe geographical locations without being there or without having
mm-hmm.
prior knowledge?
Right. It would be as if I were to ask you if you could describe where I'm going to be tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Now, you don't know me very well. You don't know what my patterns are. And furthermore, I don't know where I'll be at 3 o'clock because at that time or at 2:45, somebody's going to give me a piece of paper that says go to such and such. And now talk about high uncertainty, right?
Right.
You have no way of possibly knowing where I'm going to be at 3 o'clock, so you just rattle off whatever comes to mind.
Yes, this is beyond an educated guess.
You can't do an educated guess, because the rational answer is, I don't know.
Right.
But somehow you do know. And if you just allow your consciousness, your mind, to float freely in a free response form, and let whatever comes into your mind, you know, register and acknowledge it, and record it in some fashion, then it turns out that these abstract free response descriptions were very often uncannily accurate. And even when they weren't totally accurate, they did contain much more information than you would have gotten just by guessing. And the point of that part of our PAIR program was to try to develop some type of analytical techniques which would enable us to actually measure or quantify how much information was actually acquired compared to what you'd get just by guessing.
Would you find that the approach, let's say, to people attempting this would be to encourage them to trust themselves?
Yes. And to have fun, to think of it as a game, not to think of, oh my, now I'm doing a scientific experiment, you know, and I have to perform. It seemed to work much better when people just relaxed and let their minds roam free. We all do that. It's just we don't always give ourselves permission to do that when we're involved in a study.
Yes, and it seems as though we might know more than we think we do, or have parts of our brain activity perhaps that are more developed than we would even think of utilizing at any time in the course
yep.
of our workaday sort of life.
That's the main point of all of this. You know, here again, we found that it didn't matter how far away the people were from each other. The person describing the scene might be 2 miles away. They might be 5,000 miles away. The scene that they're trying to describe could be visited by the first person at that particular moment, or could be visited 3 days later, or 2 days before. But here again, you've got a function of consciousness that seems to be able to operate outside of the usual space and time constraints. And that's kind of mind-blowing the more you think about it.
Yes, and I'm interested in what you said about being educated out of it, as though we're, you know, these images or things we can sense or put together on an intuitive or intentional basis are natural to us, and somehow learn to take a back seat.
Well, we're taught, aren't we, that space and time are properties of the physical world. What our experiments are telling us is that, well, maybe not. Maybe space and time are properties of our minds, and maybe they're part of that organizing process by which we, who was it? I guess it may have been Albert Einstein who said space and time just keep everything from happening all at once.
Yes, but he was good at that.
he did have a way of corking off some marvelous one-liners.
Yes, our way of organizing things.
So we can manage it. Yeah, we're now confronted with the possibility that these principles, space, time, mass, charge, energy, are not properties of the physical world per se, but properties of our way of looking at the world. I think another scientist, Werner Heisenberg, said something to the effect that the physics is not a description of the world, it is a description of our way of experiencing the world. Mm-hmm. So our models of reality are just as much expressions of how we organize our experience as they are of that which we're experiencing. How then can you leave consciousness out of the equation and still get it right?
Mm. Well, Brenda, we're about halfway through the program already.
Oh, dear.
On consciousness. I want to take a short break, but please stay with us. After the break, we will continue our exploration of the effects of human consciousness with Brenda Dunn, President of International Consciousness Research Laboratories at Princeton. Here is part of a song by someone who remains one of our favorites around the Godspeed Institute, certainly on a journey of consciousness himself. Perhaps you'll remember his voice. Stay with us.
On the road of experience, I'm trying to find my own way. Sometimes I wish that I could fly away. When I think that I'm moving, suddenly
everything stands still. I'm afraid, 'cause I think they always will. And I'm looking for space and find out who I am. And I'm looking to know and understand. It's a sweet, sweet dream. Sometimes despair, all alone in the universe, 'cause sometimes that's how it seems. I get lost in the sadness and the screams, and I look in the center. Everything's clear. I find myself in the sunshine and my dreams, yes. And I'm looking for space and to find out who I am.
Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. Born John Dusseldorf, changed his name to Denver for the city he connected with intentionally on his journey. We're talking about consciousness with Brenda Dunn, president of the International Consciousness Research Laboratories in Princeton, New Jersey. Now, Brenda, I'd like to go back to a phrase you said before the break about space and time are possibly properties of the mind, which, of course, brings to my mind that perhaps at the core of science is also a core of spirituality. When I consider things that I've learned, for example, turning water to wine, perhaps, is just being a higher consciousness of who we are in our surroundings and our environment. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. You know, science grew out of spirituality. The earliest scientists that we think of, the founders of the scientific revolution, were virtually all practicing alchemists. They were mystics. And they came to their work with a very spiritual perspective, looking for the divine in the physical world. As we became more and more focused on the physical world per se, because it's a lot easier to measure than the divine, we tended to dismiss the spiritual aspects more and more. And we ended up with a science that was very materialistic, very reductionistic, and dismissive of intangibles like consciousness or love or spirit or beauty, and we were dealing only with things that could be measured. So, you know, in our pair work, what we attempted to do was to find ways to measure this intangible. You know, in the human machine experiments, we found that intention was only one part of the picture. The people who were able to consistently produce results also spoke of resonance. They talked of being on the same wavelength with the machine. They talked of being in tune with the other person in a remote perception experiment. Mm. It was a much more, if you will, wave-like description than a particulate one. We wanted to test this business of resonance, and we did a body of remote perception experiments in which we brought a portable REG into environments that were particularly moving, that were very meaningful. There might be a religious service, a musical concert, a group coming together to meditate, whatever it might be. And the device was just left running in the background with no intention at all. And we found, again, that during these periods of strong resonance, of interpersonal connection, the random event generators were again producing results that were significantly deviated from their chance behavior. And another wonderful example of that is some experiments where we brought people together and said, okay, person A, you can produce this kind of result. Person B, you can produce this. What happens if you put A and B together? Do you end up with a result that looks like A plus B, or do you get an AB that's completely different? Well, we did get an AB that was completely different and was, again, statistically replicable for that pair of operators. But what was really wonderful was it turned out that if those two people were in love, if they were what we call bonded pairs, their results were something like 7 times larger than what they could produce alone.
Well, so you're measuring consciousness and at the same time seeing love as well.
Yeah, we're measuring love. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting that science does seem to be able to support a lot of, you know, what we would consider spiritual concepts through technology these days in terms of, for example, the experiments on those who have passed away having actually, you know, being weighed for the difference if something has changed or gone from the person, as well as the people studying the effects on prayer on those in the hospitals, whether they're aware of it or not. The sort of coming together of minds, helping in the health field, and the intention there. You do so much work, and have done for so much, you know, so many years. I'd like also to be able to touch base on some other things that you've worked on, other projects like the cognitive archaeology and sacred landscapes, the Eastern and Western traditions relating to consciousness between mind and body health. I'd like to get a little more into some different projects and what you've learned.
Sure. To do that, I need to kind of create a segue from PAIR to ICRL. The PAIR laboratory at the university closed in 2007. And some years before that, we realized that we would want to continue this work, but to be able to use broader brushstrokes, to be able to ask questions that were too constrained by the laboratory, the university environment.
Right.
And we set up this not-for-profit organization called International Consciousness Research Laboratories that was made up of a group of our colleagues, some of them our former interns, who shared our interest in these topics, but who came from many different perspectives and both personal and professional backgrounds. The archaeoacoustics study, for example, was a very good exemplar of this. We visited a number of ancient ceremonial sites with a colleague of ours, Paul Devereaux, and his wife, Sharla. And he had a lot of expertise on the archaeological background. We came along as engineers with acoustical measuring devices and recorders and so forth. We discovered that a lot of these places tended to have a fundamental resonance at about 110 hertz, which seemed rather odd because it was consistent. There were about that frequency in many different places from different eras. When we looked at some of the data, it was clear that this was intentional. In fact, some of the rock art seemed to be demonstrating these wave patterns. Mm. And later, another colleague from ICRL took a look at the effects of 110 hertz stimulation on the brain and discovered that the human brain goes into a different mode around that around that frequency, one that's similar to what might be observed in either deep sleep or deep meditation. So, I mean, these people way back when knew something, and we had forgotten, and just by accident or luck or fortune, we stumbled upon it, and this seems to have stimulated a whole new field of archaeoacoustics, and people are finding all kinds of acoustical properties in ancient sites that they hadn't paid much attention to before. This is what ICRL is about. It's bringing people from with different points of view to work together, addressing tough questions, and we find that the collaborations can produce far more creative and productive areas of study than one could ever encounter just going at it from one specialty or another.
You know, not far from Stonehenge is a place called Avebury, which is the largest, oldest stone circle, actually, in England. Perhaps Stonehenge is a decoy.
I had the same impression myself.
Because at Avebury, which has these enormous boulders spread out over 28 acres, so you can't even perceive it as in one, you know, visual, there's a just basic research that, I mean, even tourists do, where you hold up your light meter, and, you know, you hold it up to the horizon, which is nice and bright, and then you put it way down to the ground where the stone meets the earth, and it should be dark there, and the light meter reads brighter.
Mm-hmm.
As though these things are along some kind of grid or have some pattern to them that, you know, now you've put sound to it, that makes me wonder if does then consciousness have a substance?
Well, you go beyond sound. Many of these sites, were like Stonehenge or some of the others, Newgrange, are also clear astronomical observatories. They were designed in such a way as to reflect, you know, the rising sun at the winter solstice or the setting sun at the spring equinox or some such. These were interdisciplinary research institutions, if you will, where astronomy and sound and light and meditation and measurement all came together. This was science at its most fundamental, and it's really what we, ICRL, aims to return to. We speak of recovering the spiritual substance of science.
Yes, in that wholeness, which included the meaning and the intent.
Exactly.
And not just the statistics, per se.
Yeah, and, yeah, we're not out to destroy science or get rid of
it. No.
What we want to do is encourage science to broaden its horizons, to take into consideration the subjective dimensions of experience as well as the objective ones, to recognize the complementarity between these two aspects, the inner and the outer, the experienced and the observed, and find a science that can pull these together for a more full representation of ourselves relating to, interacting with the world around us.
Now, with these things, like we've discussed briefly about, you know, Avebury and Newgrange and such, these are also part of our human history. And, you know, sort of reaching back to embrace these things again, do you find resistance in the current scientific community in terms of this, the work and the goals of the organization?
Well, it's interesting. We didn't find any resistance to the archaeoacoustic phenomena. That didn't seem to challenge too many sacred cows,
as it were.
The pair work has run into resistance because the concepts, you know, the idea that space and time are subjective concepts is very heretical. The lack of distance, the between the operator and the machine, the fact that the physical world can be influenced by subjective variables, that's disturbing. And, I mean, understandably. But some people respond to that kind of disturbance by saying, wow, I want to find out more about this. And others dismiss it by saying, as one person did, this is the sort of thing I wouldn't believe in even if it were true.
And even if you've shown them results.
Yeah, and what we're finding is much more gratifying is the interest and enthusiasm of a younger generation. And this is where ICRL aims its, its story. The people who want to know, the younger folks who believe there's more, who feel that what they're being taught is biased or not complete, and they are drawn in droves to the work that we're doing. It's really what motivates and sustains ICRL. We decided when we closed the PEAR laboratory that it didn't make much sense to spend our time and energy arguing with people who didn't want to hear what we had to say, when we could be arguing, if you will, or discussing these things with people who really have thought about them and who wanted to know more. And to this end, our organization, which I might mention is a not-for-profit and survives solely on contributions.
Yes, go ahead.
Hint, hint. It really took off. We, because of the similar difficulties in publishing topics of this sort, we started our own press, the ICRL Press, which reissued the book that we wrote back in 1987 called Margins of Reality, which was a description of the PEAR work up to that point. We're now just finishing a sequel to that called Consciousness and the Source of Reality, the PEAR Odyssey. And it will be published by ICRL Press, and it should be out almost any day, certainly no later than the beginning of the year. And it tells the story of PEAR. It tells the story of what we did, what we learned, and what we think the implications are. And there are a lot of people who seem to be very enthusiastic about this sort of thing. So rather than fight with folks who say, no, we can't publish this, there's no interest, we'll publish it for those people who are interested. And there are a lot of them. Most of all, it's far more gratifying to find that reaction of people who say, hey, wow, I've often thought this, but I thought I was alone. I thought I was the only one. And isn't it great that there are other people who are thinking along these lines or actually studying these things? We're far from having anything like a complete, a comprehensive body of knowledge, but we've made a start. We've learned some important things, and we've raised some important questions that'll guide the research in its next era. And that's the exciting part. And that's the audience that we embrace.
Well, it's also interesting that you mentioned the younger people, because so much of the technology has changed so much since the punch cards of 1979 that now, for example, with things like texting,
yep,
that are instantaneous communication,
yes,
the consciousness is changing. It's almost lifting off, where it's same time, and it's. Whereas many people some older folks have sort of disparaged the new technology as, kids don't talk to each other anymore, they're disconnected. The fact may be that they're constantly connected.
Yes.
And constantly communicating, but in a different way.
This information technology is a powerful tool. In science, there are essentially three currencies in which science deals. There's mass, there's energy, and there's information. And the Newtonian world was the world that dealt in mass. The quantum world is the world that dealt in energy. The new world is the information world. And one of the most interesting aspects of information, unlike mass or energy, is that information is inherently subjective, because information implies and contains or suggests meaning, and meaning is a subjective factor. It is what consciousness does. And so when you're talking about information, you have to talk not only about the description, the words, but what do the words mean? How are the words interpreted? And it opens the door to a science that can embrace subjective factors where, you know, earlier domains of science could not. And this is what I think the young people realize. And this is why they're so attracted to it.
Yes.
I might mention one other organization that we're affiliated with that encourages this, in case your readers are interested, your listeners, I'm sorry.
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
Are interested. And that's the Society for Scientific Exploration, SSE. Its website is scientificexploration.org. And this was founded, Bob John was one of the founding members of this group back about 30 years ago. And it was it's a professional society that was constructed to provide a forum for scientists who were looking at topics that other scientific organizations refuse to acknowledge. And it might be things like we're doing, you know, consciousness-related anomalies. It might be things like placebo effects or cold fusion or energy healing and so forth. But this is a place where scientists can come together and share their work with an open-minded peer group. We have a peer-reviewed journal that comes out quarterly. We have a magazine. And, of course, there's the website. We have annual meetings. But this is also a wonderful community for people who want to push that scientific paradigm beyond its current box. So that's the Society for Scientific Exploration.
Well,
I mention it because I happen to be
yes.
the education officer of SSE. And my goal is to try to attract more young people into this organization and to involve them.
Well, you mentioned a very important word before, which is meaning.
Yes.
And in, you know, this society, in our world, which appears to be increasingly polarized and fragmented, but at the same time offering us just unprecedented avenues of technology and communication that seem to be, you know, so promising, you know, in terms of helping us move forward, I could see where, you know, that search for meaning, you know, in all these fragments, you know, what is this going to mean for us and life for the future? So the information that you learn from their studies, how do you imagine them then being beneficial or utilized in the world?
Well, I think first they have to be recognized and accepted and respected. I think as our scientific understanding grows, our culture will change. Our culture always changes. And I'm not just talking about, you know, society, but our art, our music, our architecture all reflect the values and the qualities that define, you know, who we are. I don't think any of these things are going to be have a particular impact until they can become useful, until we can have tools that actually demonstrate this for the guy on the street, not having to wait around for some scientist to come along and say this is okay and that's not okay, but to produce tools, games, if you like, that people can play with, that they can use for self-exploration. Another aspect of our ICRL group is a company called Psyleron. That's Psyleron. And Psyleron produces random event generators for people who want to explore this type of human-machine experiments. They have these wonderful lamps, mind lamps, that change color randomly, and the colors seem to very often reflect the color you want it to be or the mood that you're in. They have a wonderful texting service that sends you texts at random intervals with random messages that far often than they should seem to be meaningful. And you know, people can have access to this. They can find out for themselves. They're not going to have to wait for some authority to tell them it's okay or it's not. This is what I think has driven so many people away from mainstream medicine and into alternative health care.
Yes.
They feel that there's more than what they're being told, and they want to see for themselves. And there is an ancient lore in medicine, just as there is an ancient lore in alchemy, that our contemporary science and medicine doesn't want to acknowledge, mainly because they don't understand it. And I've discovered that three words that scientists seem to be have a great deal of difficulty saying is, I don't know.
Right. Or let's find out, or let's have fun.
Well, let's start out with a little humility. Let's start out by saying, I don't know. And let's see what we can learn from that position. If we listen to each other, if we can listen to ideas of people from other backgrounds and other fields of interest, if artists could talk to scientists, and if healthcare practitioners could talk to housewives and mothers, you know, we might all advance in a productive way. But certainly it has to get out there to the guy on the street.
Yes, and who feels that there's more to us than what meets the eye.
You know, if I could take a moment and just read you a paragraph from the prologue of our new book that I think sort of summarizes this.
Yes, we've got 1 minute left.
That's about what I need. When we first embarked on this exotic scholarly journey more than three decades ago, our aspirations were little higher than to attempt replication of some previously asserted anomalous results that might conceivably impact future engineering practice, either negatively or positively, and to pursue those ramifications to some appropriate extent. But as we followed that torturous research path deeper into its metaphysical forest, it became clear that far more fundamental epistemological issues were at stake, and strange, far stranger phenomenological creatures were on the prowl than we had originally envisioned, and that a substantially broader range of intellectual and cultural perspectives would be required to pursue that trek productively. This text is our attempt to record some of the tactics developed, experiences encountered, and understanding acquired in this mist-shrouded exploration, in the hope that their preservation in this format will encourage and enable deeper future scholarly penetrations into the ultimate source of reality.
Thank you so much for that quote. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but you've summed it up so beautifully. I want to thank you for being with us today, Brenda.
There's so much to discuss.
Perhaps we can speak again in the future.
I'd enjoy that. And I want to thank you for providing this opportunity to share some of these ideas with the wider world.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, for what it's worth, I'm going to bet you'll at 3 o'clock tomorrow you will be at your desk in your lab. We'll see how it goes.
Pretty good shot.
And thank you, listeners.
Again. Well, thank you, Carol. Have a good day.
You
Godspeed.
Thank you. Listeners, if you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply visit our website at www.godspeedinstitute.com. We hope you've enjoyed today's program and hope you will join us again as we continue to explore the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, Godspeed.